Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. Our speaker is Dr. Catherine Bliss from the Department of Africana Studies and Science and Technology Studies at Brown University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Linda Hayward, Director of Boston University's African American Studies Program.
We are so happy to have our speaker, Professor and Dr. Catherine Bliss, who earned her BA in Women's Studies from the University of California, Santa Cruz, her MA in Ethnic Studies from San Francisco State University in San Francisco, California, and her PhD in Sociology from the New School of Social Research in New York City. Professor Bliss has published works in the International Journal of Technology, Knowledge, and Society, the Ethnic Studies Journal, and the Encyclopedia of Applied Ethics. Professor Bliss is right now at Brown University. She's the Howard Hughes Medical Institute Postdoctoral Fellow in Biomedicine, Medical Humanities, and Science and Technology Studies. Her research examines the construction and naturalization of race and gender categories in contemporary biomedicine. Her interests include health controversies, emergent science, racial identity, and the science of sexual difference. Dr. Bliss is the author of Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice, published by Stanford University, 2012. Her book provides a first look at the racial views and practices of the world's leading genome scientists, exposing how scientists draw on common sense ideas, norms, and values about race to formulate their research. It's an exciting, cutting-edge research, and we're looking forward to your presentation, Dr. Bliss. Thank you again, and give us here a hand.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thanks for having me. I'm very glad to be able to talk to you about my book, Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice. I'm going to start by setting a stage on what's been going on with the political climate since the mapping of the human genome. Just a quick show of hands, how many of you are familiar with the event that's in this image, or how many of you know the people who are in this image? Okay, more people know the people. So, of course, this is a press photo taken of the celebratory remarks made at the White House at the culmination of the Human Genome Project in the year 2000. It was actually the culmination of the first draft of the Human Genome Map. In the center, we, of course, have Bill Clinton, and on his right, we have Craig Venter, who was the leader of the private effort to map the human genome. He's now known for being the first person to create a synthetic organism. And the guy on Clinton's left is Francis Collins, who was the director of the Human Genome Project, the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute during the Human Genome Project, and is also currently the director of the entire National Institutes of Health, or NIH. Something that those of you who are familiar with these people and this event may not be so familiar with is that at this very ceremony, Clinton and these gentlemen and others here talked about the benefits of genomics for social uplift around race. So Clinton said genomics proved that humans were, quote, more than 99.9% the same. And the scientists here said, yeah, scientific investigation into race is going to go no further. We have closed the book on the question of race. Collins, again, this gentleman over here, soon after was quoted as saying, those who wish to draw precise racial boundaries around races, around certain groups, will not be able to use science as a legitimate justification. And Venter over here agreed, what we've shown is the concept of race has no scientific basis. Well, when we come from then, the year 2000, to today, what we see is the emergence of companies and television programs, documentary films, that now offer people the chance to trace their racial origins, to find roots in distant continents. and to make political claims to rights and resources based on their test results. So people can use their test results for college admissions or to enroll in Native American tribes or particular tribes that get resources from the government. And this is actually even more true in biomedicine. So Francis Collins, again, the director of the NIH, for example, has reversed course and by 2004 was saying, we need to try to understand what there is about genetic variation that is associated with disease risk and how that correlates in some very imperfect way with self-identified race. So recent American Society of Human Genetics presidents and leaders of the subsequent genome projects, there have been a number of genome projects since the Human Genome Project finished, have made research into racial health disparities a goal. Also, there's been a deluge of studies since the early 2000s testing whether people's self-identified racial affiliations match their the profiles that can be assigned to them from genetic clustering software. So genomics essentially went from being unanimous on the uselessness of race to deeply interested in getting it right and understanding what there is about the biology of race that's important to us. Viewing this striking reversal in the late 2000s, I asked myself, how is it that when, you know, we weren't supposed to even be using race and biology in the same sentence for so many decades, how is it that we now have this full-fledged genomic investigation into race? What I found through qualitative research that focuses on leading scientists themselves, so leaders of the genome projects, is that despite the elegant kabuki of that 2000 meeting, race was actually never a dead issue in science. So some of you might have read Stephen Epstein's Policy Analysis or some portion of it, this book, Inclusion, the Politics of Difference. This book showed us that actually at this very moment in the early 2000s, race consciousness in the form of minority inclusion was actually institutionalized throughout biomedicine. And this is actually an important, laudable, valuable shift. But if we look at genomics proper, what we will see is that scientists have really gone above and beyond the call of duty, forming personal attachments to the use of race, mobilizing like activists, and really making knowledge about race a personal research priority. So these scientists have been doing good science, but they inadvertently reify race or make it seem more natural and true from a biological standpoint in their emphasis on using genomic tools to address problems of the color line. What does this say about racial expertise? Well, in a world where people are increasingly socializing and socialized around their biology and their own genetic information, their DNA codes, scientists have been hailed into a series of public debates to think proactively about the biosocial effects of racism, racial injustice, and their impact on the politics of representation and people's identity processes. And they've actually had to learn how to manage governmental politics as the state has attempted to provide biosocial welfare to the national population along racial lines. So genomicists working worldwide are mandated to use the government's set of racial categories, the census categories, that all people working in biomedicine and, in fact, all publicly funded research has to use. So this is true for research conducted worldwide, genomic research conducted worldwide. But what I find most surprising is that I found that scientists are also assuming a proactive political stance on the use of race in genomics. So they're ethically pragmatic about the construction of human taxonomies. They strategically use racial or quasi-racial categories to engender minority inclusion. And as I was saying, they're inspired by this activist ethos that's rampant in the political mainstream. So this is in part because scientists' own subjectivities are looped into the process. There's no barrier between lab and policy disputes, ethical debates, and their own personal issues. So they've been making sense of their own identity politics through the rubric of genomics, either as minority-identified scientists or as scientists who identify as white and are attempting to witness racial injustice or health inequality, and they're attempting to do something about it. So what I'm arguing is that expertise is being refashioned in a biosocial world, and I'll tell you what I mean by biosocial in a moment. To meet ethical goals and to change our ethical and political reality, scientists have had to change what counts as biology and how they do their science. And racial research really shows very, very clearly the inextricability of scientific knowledge, production, and also racial problem solving in the genomic era. So I've repurposed the anthropologist Paul Rabinow's characterization of biosociality as sociality that's based on genetic ancestry, whereas he said groups formed around genomic classifications will have medical specialists, laboratories, narratives, traditions, and a heavy panoply of pastoral keepers to help them experience, share, intervene in, and understand their fate. Instead, I place researchers and their subjectivity at the center of these biosocial processes. So I show that genomic elites are part of our biosocial world. They fiercely criticize race, and they just as fiercely defend its role in medical research because they see race as being something biologically questionable and something they need to solve the problem of, but they also see race as socially and politically important. So in this sense, genomic biosociality is reflexive. Classification really depends on overt ethical, political agendas that are designed to move our world toward a specific future of racial relations. Michael Omi and Howard Winant, some other sociologists that you might have come into contact with in your research, they also draw our attention to racial projects and racial paradigms. So they define a racial project as a movement to reorganize and redistribute resources along racial lines. And they also have a definition for what they call racial paradigms, which are assumed theoretical categories that classify racial phenomena. So Omi and Winant ask us to unpack processes of classification, especially biological or biologically focused conceptualizations that really have the power to change our social order and our social relations. So I find that genomics is taking us into a new paradigm, a new racial paradigm for dealing with race. And I call this the sociogenomic paradigm. So sociogenomics is the view that biology has a genetically determined component and a socially constructed component. Under this paradigm lies the notion that the only way to produce equality in this world is to become cognizant of racial difference, to celebrate diversity, to capitalize on common lay understandings of racial difference, and to invest in and support minority concepts of solidarity and identity. But to ultimately study biological systems with genomic tools. So I'll take you into my methods for a second. Whom did I study to reach these conclusions? I was very, very fortunate to get the participation of 36 of the world's leading genomic scientists. So these are leaders of international sequencing projects and global health studies, people like the gentleman from the previous slide, Craig Venter and Francis Collins, also chief officials of the main professional societies and journals. So these names may be less familiar to you, but people like Lynn Jord, Aravinda Chakravarti, Charles Rotimi, and others who are directing biotechnology and pharmaceutical companies either as CSOs or CEOs or founders. So these are people who lead genomics in non-human as well as human research. They direct projects all over the world. They're not just based in the US or the UK or Canada. And just one side note, because they're public figures, I obtained permission to use their names in conjunction with their quotes, but with sensitive material, I refrain from identifying them. So we can talk more about how I accomplished this study if you're interested, if you're doing qualitative research yourself. But I'll just briefly tell you that from April 2007 to June 2008, I flew out to scientists' labs. I met them at their corporate headquarters. I saw where they did their work and conducted in-depth interviews with them, many of which I followed up with informal interviews, Skype conversations, emails, etc. I also conducted participant observation, first of three population genomic studies in a private lab, foundation's lab, that provides ancestry estimation, a kind of genome mapping service to labs around the world. And at this site, I shadowed a lab researcher and his two assistants. And then second of policy meetings in which the scientists that I interviewed participated. So there I made contacts with policymakers, bioethicists, and academic critics of genomics interest in race. And I was subsequently able to interview them as well. And finally, I looked at over 3,000 journals, websites, and other textual films, etc. And I performed discourse analysis of the 732 articles, project records, media transcripts, and documents pertaining to the field's research into race from the mid-1980s to 2010. So the book is really the broadest survey of the field of genomics to date. So it goes beyond one single lab or a narrow set of labs that are connected somehow. Also, my study extends beyond the turn of the 21st century, where most other studies, at least the studies that have been published so far, have really left off. So this is when genomics was coming under the purview of the federal race policy, the OMB, or Office of Management and Budgets, Directive Number 15, also known to many as the census categories. There's another really great book. Jenny Reardon has a book on the Human Genome Diversity Project. Some of you may have read a chapter or two from it. This book showed that the Genome Project that was trailing the Human Genome Project, this Human Genome Diversity Project, it's a project that promised to be the first non-Eurocentric genome project. Until the late 90s, scientists involved with this project and scientists in the field in general were really immersed in a tradition of branding themselves as colorblind anti-racists. So the scientists involved in this project and scientists in general in the early 1990s, before the advent of this government mandate to use the census categories, they really tried to communicate a belief that race was soon going to be erased through the mixing of races, which you see represented by this Time magazine cover from 1993. That was the sentiment of the time. So scientists then, what they did was they tried to strip the word race of any hierarchical connotations. Genome scientists were saying, you know, there's no different. People might be different, but they're not better or worse than each other. What most scientists did was just simply stop using the word race. So in their publications, there's a dearth of the word race appearing during this time. Whereas if you look at the 80s, you look at subsequent to this middle time period, you'll see that the word race pops up a lot. It's all over the place. By the mapping of the human genome, however, the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration began requiring that researchers report drug differences in the biology of drug response and drug dosage by those census categories. So what we have here is the targeted planned enrollment form, which all researchers, this is the NIH's form, but basically all researchers continue to have to use these categories, just like when you fill out the census. So also from 2000 to 2003, the NIH flooded genomic research institutes and actually all of its 27 institutes with $1.3 billion in funding to study racial health disparities, but also to sharpen genomic methods. So their strategic plans to eliminate health disparities from 2000 to 2003 were giving money to do both things at the same time. more genomics, more health disparities research. So health disparities has really since become a priority across the board for public health. And there's been a widespread founding of genomic health disparities centers of research excellence. Also, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, has its own intramural center for health disparities genomics, which has now been renamed as the Center for Global Health, but before it was called the Center for Health Disparities Genomics. And also by the mid-2000s, there were talks of genome projects that would focus on specific continental populations, so Africa, the Americas. So with ethnography of policy forums, debates, and also lab science, Race Decoded shows us that the reason for this change happened, due to the successful efforts of advocates and academic critics in convincing scientists that colorblindism was bad policy. It didn't work. So it didn't solve racism. It also masked institutional racism or institutionalized racism. And it made genomics seem irrelevant to understanding the transmission of inequality across generations. So critics and advisors really came in with this message that racial inequality was important. And if you look at the minutes of meetings across genomic funding consortia and their funding agencies, you see this message coming up all over the place. And it also comes through in the language of calls for funding during this time. And of course, it shows in the billions of dollars that were being circulated in research, in biomedical research, that went into promoting health disparities from a genomic perspective. And the message really resonated with scientists who were ready for a new politicization around race. Scientists' message became, we actually need affirmative action at the level of the molecule or at the level of the gene. So race was essentially folded into genomics because of its overt socio-political significance. But the socio-political significance took on an original, unique kind of biosocial form, as I'm going to now show you with some examples of sociogenomics in scientists' own terms. I'm going to take us through the most common yet striking themes that came up in my research interviews. First and foremost, scientists are resolutely concerned with diversification. Scientists believe that genetic science has been Eurocentric and that they must be vigilant about health disparities research. Mark Feldman, who is a leading population genomicist at Stanford, said, in the university situation, you today are forced into acknowledging what race means because of affirmative action and the fact that we have so few minorities on the faculty and so few coming up to be on the faculty in the next generation. If you do demography like I do, then you also have to continually focus on what's the difference in life expectancy and morbidity between the different self-classified racial groups within the US. This is a scientist who has been at the forefront of racial policy disputes for decades. He's also trained a generation of Genome Project leaders. His comments show us that there are complex ways that the thought of or consideration of race brings up anxieties for scientists. Scientists like him who are situated in what are predominantly government-funded labs, who are constantly called into interdisciplinary meetings as science advisors on race, often spoke about the importance of affirmative action and research inclusion in the same breath. So research inclusion is their social justice weapon. Scientists feel personally responsible for a proactive minority inclusion paradigm, and many talked about creating drug studies that target specific minority groups. They also worried about racial minorities being left out of personalized medicine if they weren't vigilant about doing this targeted research. Whether running a drug company or an academic lab or both, as most of the scientists that I interviewed do, scientists were concerned about what they called the downstream implications for drug development and for access to genomic science. And I want you to take note of how this politicization opens the door for the importation of social categories of race, even as scientists criticize these categories and criticize the concept of biological race. Another related issue that surfaced was how to operationalize inclusion in politically sensitive ways. Scientists talk about genomics as a human right, as something that every human on Earth deserves access to, and they pride themselves on their politically sensitive relationships with groups that they can use as proxies for the larger population, whether that's the U.S. population or the U.K. population, and especially with respect to U.S. racial minorities. What's interesting is that they actually use strategic deployments of minority scientists in order to engender inclusion akin to the strategic essentialism that we see in identity politics. So strategic essentialism is really the presentation of a unified sense of groupness strategically in order to gain rights and resources for that group. So what they do is they calibrate researcher identity and subject identity in highly political ways that you really do see in the political mainstream. Like when I asked David Altshuler, who is a Genome Project PI from the International HapMap Project, he's here at the Broad Institute in Boston, how they formulated their racialized Europe versus Asia versus Africa comparative population-based database. And this is the largest and most centrally used set of genomes so far in existence. He said, there was a discussion about whom we should sample. We could have done it all in America, and that was felt not to be a good idea. That for political more than scientific reasons, that if you were going to have a sample from Japan, it would be good if it was collected in Japan as opposed to first-generation Japanese Americans. It's sort of a self-determination thing, you know, that Charles Rotimi, somebody who is African and worked in Africa for many years, do it as opposed to someone else. Altshuler really explained what other projects leaders talked about frequently, that they were managing inclusion with a heightened sensitivity to identity. So this isn't a politically ignorant or colorblind approach, but rather one that's conscious of self-determination, cultural competency, and racial sensitivities. Those scientists that are affiliated with the HapMap project, this large genome sequencing project, mostly reject the idea of biological races. They do support the inclusion of minorities on their own terms, and sometimes this is with using color-coded terms like white or black, and at other times, they use terms that are sufficient for a broad census-like version of inclusion. So the HapMap project that this scientist is affiliated with sampled from one group in Ibadan, Nigeria, to get a rough cut of the diversity on the African continent and in people of African descent. So what I'm trying to show is that these scientists' political vision and their baseline protocols are really looped into the fielding of government policy and their management of relations with the public. And again, there's also a striking way that this loops into scientists' personal identities. There's a constant looping of personal self-interpretation and self-discovery that I'll show you more about now. So when discussing one's path to studying human variation genomics, scientists related stories of confusion over race. Many talked about having a deep-seated childhood curiosity as a result of growing up or living in segregated places, or as a result of working on human genomics and reflecting on their past experiences or experiences of people whom they care about. So they tried to make sense of these experiences with what was coming up in their scientific investigations. By way of example, Georgia Dunstan, who is a founding director of Howard University's National Human Genome Center. This is the genome institute that is entirely focused on Black American health. And she's a scientist who self-identifies as African American and has really been a go-to spokesperson for the Black community at the NIH, at the CDC, and these different public health proceedings. She told me that she got into genomics because I was looking at what we've called racial groups. What's the basis for the skin color differences? What's the basis for the anatomical structural differences where one side was right and what was and what should be desired and another was wrong and bad? So if I understood what was the basis for the difference, then maybe I could help make it all right. Now, regardless of whether this is her actual motivation, if or you know, if such a thing could be boiled down to one motivation, she now interprets her decision to found America's premier institute focused on African American health based on her own racial confusion in the past. So race is not a dirty word here, and neither is saying that understanding race is not just about biomedicine, but really about being able to make sense of one's own life. So what I'm saying is that we have to take these thought processes just as seriously as we do policy mandates and public debates or statements that we see in the public record. And again, thinking in biosocial sociogenomic terms, researchers' constructions of human taxonomy are bound to their concerns about the best way to represent people and to address the social and medical needs of communities that they have worked in and lived in. And many actually discuss studying the biology of socially constructed race. So as Georgia Dunstan, again, this researcher quoted here, put it, what's the internal influence for a person who, because of certain biological characteristics, perceives themselves or their integrity as being threatened, whether it's getting a job, losing a job, getting insurance, or losing insurance? Or as others asked, what's the relationship between living in a racist society, having dark skin, and one's genomic health? This brings me to the issue of empowerment and how scientists use their own struggles and resources to level the playing field. Esteban Burchard, who is a UCSF asthma researcher who self-identifies as Latino, related to me how his mother's experiences as a person who, quote, looked Black, impacted him, urging him toward a Latino genomics. He told me that his mom encouraged him to convert his lighter skin privilege into a science capital that could be leveraged later for his underrepresented racial kin. So he said, she told me once when I was very young, I must have been like 7, she said, you're going to be able to go places where I could never go. She taught me about this permeability. I use it today. Because of who you are and your abilities, you can go through certain scenarios back and forth, kind of like a fish going through a big net. Some fish can go back and forth while other ones will get caught. As you can see by this quote and by the last quote by Georgia Dunstan, it's a common theme among U.S. minority-identified scientists to find ways to translate their successes into a spotlight for minority concerns, U.S. racial concerns, and to also concentrate their research on their personal communities of origin. What's interesting is that they know that there's something wrong, there's something amiss with the biological model of race, but it only compels them to try to pinpoint what the problem is with genomic tools and to really create a science that is by the people, for the people, in terms that empower their racial brethren. Now, I have to reinforce that many scientists disagree about the finer points of how to actually operationalize race in the lab and in science, but all at some point discuss the need for empowerment through access to genomics. Scientists also spoke of protective empowerment. So a self-identified Jewish scientist who is very public in the media and has one of the largest multi-million dollar NIH grants, reflecting on the potential for genomics to verify Nazi assumptions, said, if I thought that it was in the best interests of people to fake my results, I'd be happy to fake it. I get myself in a great deal of trouble for saying that, but that's the reality. So this is a case of anti-racist exclusion, not inclusion, but exclusion as a means of empowering groups. I actually heard this this time and time again. And I was shown examples of studies that were scrapped for this very reason. It's important to make clear that part of my study was an analysis of all of my interviewees' publications and public statements. Scientists often shared with me their study protocols, so things like recruitment and enrollment forms. And not only did I find that their research protocols and their trajectories confirmed the sentiments that they shared with me, but I actually found many of their stories that they told me reflected in statements that were made for the public record, public appearances, public media appearances that they had made, and in the transcripts of other scholarly interviews. So empowerment is not just a fuzzy goal, but is really a materialized reality. In the case of Burchard, the Latino researcher that I just quoted, his research projects like the Genetic Asthma in Latino Americans project are carried out in a Latino-focused sociogenomics of race. The final dimension that I'll talk about is resource sharing. In addition to helping members of their communities, their immediate communities, know more about themselves with genomics and know how to treat disease in a targeted way, scientists also believe that they're creating the first comprehensively participatory science. So this is, they're envisioning this as a global science, a science that is a species-wide, species-relevant science. And so considerations of uplift in the global south and transfers of resources across the globe, and also talk about, you know, transferring resources across racial diasporas was a common theme in my interviews. For example, Rick Kittles, who's an African populations expert, who's led important prostate cancer studies and other kinds of studies for the NIH, and also is the CSO, meaning Chief Scientific Officer, of one of the most successful and visible genetic genealogy companies, African Ancestry Incorporated, said that in all of his work, he personally models African ancestry. And that he makes sure that those that he samples see themselves and their interests in his work and what he's doing. Reflecting on his role as a leader in African diaspora genomics, he said, "Many West Africans are very excited to participate because they think that it's going to bring them closer to African Americans. And then with that closeness comes support, lobbying, and tourism." In fact, the emphasis on global circulations of resources was a common thread of conversation among scientists, even if they weren't in the business of selling ancestry tests or genetic tests. Scientists were concerned about how they could mobilize around their positions to actively foster ties and to remake identities and community and to forge a sense of community in a diasporic context. Like Kittles, who's a researcher that's at the cusp of public health and private biotech, creating cultural and economic exchange and encouraging migration and immigration across national borders is a big concern for these scientists. And here what we see is really this a state-sponsored humanitarian logic of access, his own identity politics at play, but also the marketization of this sociogenomic paradigm. And it's important to say that there's tremendous payoff here. There's economic capital, symbolic capital, social capital, and all sorts of capitals to be gained for controlling the terms of racial affiliation. Scientists really benefit from fusing global research ethics, global capital, domestic racial frameworks and concerns, scientific practice, of course, and their own personal identity issues. So to sum up, what we're seeing here is really a system of racial expertise that is born of these shifting frames of governance that have an interest in a genomics of race, also a politicized and politicizing public engagement around this issue. So the issue of genomics responsibility to see and actually do something about race. And of course, this comes through in ethical debates and this positioning within the market that I just spoke of. But there's also this constant working through of personal politics and experience that brings biosocial expertise in line with people's racial projects. And this forms a distinct paradigm bent on solving racial problems with genomic methods. Needless to say, the social and environmental issues of structural violence and the everyday experiential violences that actually occupy our concerns as social scientists and humanists get short shrift. So I'm going to stop here so that we have ample time for discussion, and I'd be happy to take your questions now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bliss. Okay.
Hi, my name is Tamika. You were talking about diversification and political inclusion and the way that, basically we talk about research inclusion for scientists and how that is kind of like a political way to focus research on these minority groups and in turn get these groups to participate in research. How successful is this, like, diversification and political inclusion? Like, did you do any research into that and how it's working? Are there actually people participating in the Latino research and the and the one at Howard, the African American Health?
Well, I mean, a lot of these studies have trouble also enrolling, even in as you say, in urban centers where there's a preponderance of people who identify either as Latino or Chicano or African American, and who are really the population base of that of the city where the hospital or where the research center is located. Studies still have researchers have trouble enrolling and getting their numbers in such a way that they are. You know, oversampling enough with the populations who are considered underserved populations. As far as the researchers that I interviewed specifically, what I found was that they tried to tweak the categories handed to them from the census or from the government, and they tried to create sort of a local a locally adaptive set of categories so that they could engender inclusion, but when it came time to reporting their research results or reporting to the NIH, the census categories came back into the picture. I'm also doing a little, actually, it's kind of overly big, but it's a content analysis study with another researcher at UCLA, with Aaron Panofsky, on Nature Genetics publications through this through these Human Genome Project years, and what we're looking at is where racial classifications appear. And what we found is that so far is that what you see is in the method sections, you might have a very careful description of the specifics of the populations that were being sampled, but when you get to the level of the intro and the conclusion of a study, or when you look at the titles of studies, what you get is a lot of this blacks versus white kind of discourse. And so on the one hand, I think that something that you point to is that it's difficult, even when you do have a very clear set of categories, it's difficult to engender inclusion. And the scientists that I spoke with are very bent on engendering inclusion by some categories, if not those categories. But at the same time, the framework is there whether or not scientists are successful. Because in reporting, you must use these categories. So even if scientists say, I'm not going to be able to get the participation of these different racial groups because we have trouble with it, or I'm not even studying those groups, when it comes to reporting, that's still the same enrollment form that I showed you. Those are the categories you're going to register whoever did participate by. So you still get this, you know, well, a study that, say, doesn't even look at Latinos or doesn't even look at African Americans will still publish in its title whites something something something, right? So that's part of the system is racialized regardless of if people are successful.
First, let me say I really enjoyed your presentation. Very stimulating.
Thank you.
Been trying to teach courses on the history of racial thought, and I'm wondering if the new openness to the possibility that the concept of race may have a legitimate biological dimension has led to a rise in research that attempts to establish whether or not there's a difference in intelligence that corresponds to these new types of quasi-racial kinds of groupings?
Yeah, that's a, also a great question. And the answer is yes, there has been a resurgence of research that focuses on racial differences in intellect, intelligence, in brain function. On the other hand, the scientists who are doing these genomic studies are not they're not going forth intending to make these kinds of comparisons or to put a value judgment on the comparisons, but there are studies. There was a study in 2005 that was on brain size, and this was an evolutionary study. So, a study that was using the HapMap samples that, again, are Europe, Asia, Africa, and comparing and other samples as well, comparing these different groups according to the presence of certain alleles or gene variants. The study found that the alleles were predominantly present in populations that have come about after the migration out of Africa. So, you know, by default, that's saying, well, brain growth, brain size, the hallmark of humanness is something that happened outside of Africa. So, you know, it's like people back into these racialized claims and racial claims making, even though they might not go into it with that kind of an intention. And there are many other studies. Right now, the research that I'm doing currently is on sociogenomics in the social sciences. And this research looks at, here, I'll show you, Born Bad, the Genetics of Delinquency, looks at how social scientists are actually conducting genomic research now. And the claims that they make are about behavior, and these claims are racialized. And so even though social scientists might not go into it with a, you know, I want to make a racial claim, so they're not like, I'm racist, I want to make a white supremacy claim, still what comes up is, well, we found these problem alleles predominantly in Latinos, in our Latino samples, or in our Maori samples, as the research in New Zealand has found. So it's a resurgence for sure.
Hi, thanks for your talk. I came across exactly what you were talking about just now. I teach a world history class, and I was looking for images and maps specifically of early population movements. And I went to Google Images, just, you know, early population movements in Europe. And I found in this a number of really well-done maps showing the movement of different haplogroups across Western Europe based on the latest genetics research. And I found that all of these really high-quality maps led to a website called Stormfront, which is a neo-Nazi site. When I looked at Stormfront's stuff, I mean, a lot of what was on there was a bulletin board kind of thing. A lot of stuff was posted. It was your typical sort of racist stuff. But there were a number of contributors who had an amazingly detailed knowledge of, you know, articles that appear in highly specialized scientific literature that were publishing very articulate articles that were clearly racist, but documented with an alarming degree of scientific research and the like. And a lot of what brought me to this in the first place was they were talking about the movement of Indo-European people in particular. And, of course, this is the Aryan supremacy race and so on. But, they were really into this literature. And these guys would be the first ones in the world that we would see that could produce I don't know who they were or what their particular backgrounds were. They were using pseudonyms in the site. But it's obvious that there are people out there born to rage who are intelligent people who will use this literature against it. And I saw a lot of sloppy history backed up by very speculative science in the work that Linda and I have done over the many years here now, since 2005 or so, involved in these various genetics ancestry projects. So it's definitely out there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, I feel like the white supremacy websites are the best archives, the best digital archives of a lot of genetic research, a lot of population genomics. I mean, these groups monitor everything that's coming out, and they, you know, anything they can spin, they use it, and anything they can't spin, they put it up there anyways because somehow it's related to proving that they were right about something. And so it's really, yeah, it's fascinating how, you know, these groups get new fuel for their politics from the population genomic studies. I want to say, though, that I'm not criticizing the all population genomic research. In fact, haplogroup mapping and mitochondrial DNA research and Y chromosomal research is pretty accurate. But what you do with it, you know, is the question. And one of the things that's so fascinating about the really large scale genome sequencing projects is that when scientists have this opportunity to make a decision, should we go by what we've seen with the haplogroups, or should we go into some sort of racialized, you know, continental comparative, you know, framework? Because of our very important policies of minority inclusion, racial inclusion, you get scientists making the choice to abandon what they know about human migrations, which is that population differences are so specific to local context that that's what we really should be focusing on. And scientists are willing to go continental with it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Catherine Bliss from the Department of Africana Studies and Science and Technology Studies at Brown University. Dr. Bliss's lecture was titled Race Decoded, The Genomic Fight for Social Justice, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was Linda Hayward, director of Boston University's African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.